WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
WFAE.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. This hour, as we did with our coverage of the Democratic National Convention, we joined forces with WFAE News for a pre-election roundup. We'll explore where the state and the nation stand on this day before the election with the incredibly tight presidential race, and we'll examine the North Carolina judicial contests. The state's 8th and 9th congressional races are close to home and of high interest, so we delve into the politics, the issues, and the candidates there, as well as the Mecklenburg County Commission races. But we begin with the gubernatorial contest, and we're joined by WFAE News reporters Michael Tomczyk and Lisa Miller, who have been covering the candidates in this race since the beginning. And throughout the program, Dr. Michael Bitzer, associate professor and chair of the Department of Politics and History at Catawba College in Salisbury, and WFAE's The Party Line political blogger, will be with us to provide his expert analysis. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Is this Pat McCrory's race to lose, Dr. Bitzer?
Oh, immensely. I mean, you know, looking at all the polls, he has consistently held double digits. He's now typically over 50%. It would just be a political earthquake if he did not lose.
Now, you follow the polls and the early voting trends, and this is a question for just not only the gubernatorial campaign, but for the presidential campaign as well. Do these campaigns, they do their own polls, they have their own tentacles out. Do they know in advance, like a week ago? Did they know a week ago, or did they know yesterday whether they're going to win or lose?
I think they see it in the tea leaves. I really do. I think a lot of campaigns run internal polls, and they tend to match up nicely with the public polls as well. You know, for a candidate who seems to be, you know, on the downhill slide, who's losing by double digits, it's got to be hard for them to keep up the public face because they want their voters, they want their supporters to come out and be energized. Certainly, this race is not going to be won by double digits. It will tighten up. We'll see straight party ticket voting helping him. But at the end of the day, I think Tuesday, we'll see Governor-elect McCrory.
Of course, we don't know the outcome, and Election Day is tomorrow, and as you say, something seismic could happen. So let's talk about the candidates and the campaigns. If Walter Dalton wins, he will most likely have to contend with a Republican legislature. Will he be able to put through any of his policy initiatives in that situation?
Boy, it'd be tough for me to see that. I mean, definitely the Republicans will hold the General Assembly. They will probably hold it with a veto majority proof as well. So it's going to take a lot of compromising, particularly on a governor-elect Dalton's part.
And a governor-elect McCrory is coming from the great state of Mecklenburg. and I know that we have a Huntersville native as Speaker of the House, but he's an outsider. He's not a state government guy. What success? And he ticked off the legislature several years ago when he was mayor. Of course, it was a Democratic legislature. Yeah. But what success might he have?
I think it's going to be interesting to watch that dynamic, particularly with the state Senate. I would see Pat McCrory and Tom Tillis working much closely together than I would necessarily with Phil Berger, simply because the state Senate tends to be a little more conservative. And I think the pragmatism of the House and wanting to get things done, you know, unified government is a great thing, but it can throw some hiccups into the road.
So, Michael Tomczyk, we have these two candidates. One's from Charlotte. One is not Charlotte. Charlotte does not like the rest of the state, and the rest of the state doesn't like us. And there's some concern, I would think, around the state about a Governor McCrory, isn't there?
There is somewhat. One of the things that intrigued me about all this, Mike, was if you know, say the business folks in southeastern North Carolina, where I'm from, if they were actually, you know, concerned. It's been such a long time since we had a charlatan in the governor's office. You know, would there be some worry about, you know, this guy would focus too much energy just on, you know, the Charlotte area? But you know, when both McCrory and Dalton have been out campaigning, I mean, they've made it very clear we're going to be a governor for the entire state. McCrory was actually speaking at a campaign event at Catawba College in Salisbury, and this was kind of his quick thing about being mayor and then how it can work for the whole state.
I became mayor at 39 years of old, and for 14 years I was proud to be mayor, and we built an economic powerhouse 45 miles from here. Now why not do it for the rest of the state of North Carolina?
He talks about that in one of his campaign commercials, in fact.
Oh, yeah. I mean, every single time I've seen him speak, that's basically been what he's come back to. Look what I did for Charlotte. I can do it for the whole state.
Right.
Now, so Dalton, of course, also is going to be, you know, in charge of the whole state and has said that, you know, he's going to take care of everyone. And the way he kind of addressed this issue of, you know, are you going to look more one place than the others? He says this is something that comes up every time. And this is what he told you, actually, a couple weeks ago on Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte may be jealous of Raleigh because they think Raleigh gets everything. I will tell you, Raleigh is jealous of Charlotte. They think Charlotte gets everything. The urban areas think the rural areas get too much. The rural areas think the urban areas get too much. And the East thinks the West gets it, and the West thinks the East gets it. It is one state. We have to work together, and I am the one that will lead us and pull us together.
Well, I like his taste in music.
Right, but I mean, so if we get down to the concern, though, I mean, is there actually a concern? Some of the business folks down East that I talked to said that, you know, I mean, yeah, it's a thought, but at the same time, I think that, at least among the ones that I spoke to, they were overwhelmingly more excited about the prospect of having a businessman like McCrory back in the governor's office, and that kind of outweighed that concern for them. For example, there's Charles Devon runs a construction company in Elizabethtown, and he's certainly one of the people who are excited, and here's what he had to say.
As to how it will affect this area of the state, I don't think you can do anything for Charlotte that's not going to help the East in some way or the mountains in some way. Hmm. Anything that affects us affects them, and increase the tax base in Charlotte and you increase the tax base on the state, and that's better for us.
So it's kind of, you know, a rising tide, you know, lifts all boats.
Yeah.
So, and the kind of last point on this, one actual kind of practical thing that a couple of the business leaders brought up to me that would show McCrory is going to be focusing elsewhere if he were to be elected would be throw some people in your cabinet or in the Department of Transportation that are from southeastern North Carolina, that are from different parts of the state, so that clearly you've got a team of advisors who get the whole state.
Jobs and taxes were a front burner issue in this campaign. Both talk about the need to attract business, which brings jobs. Both talk about incentives for business. But what are they saying? Dalton talks about, what, competitive incentives, and McCrory talks about lowering taxes, right? Is that essentially what's been said in this campaign?
Yeah, pretty much so. I mean, I think the tax reform is going to be definitely high on the agenda, particularly from the legislature's point of view.
So how much of a problem is it, do you think, that North Carolina has the highest tax burden in the Southeast at 9.9%, while our next-door neighbor, South Carolina, has the lowest at only 8.4%? What is it, 1.5% difference? How big a deal is that?
I mean, I think it's definitely a factor when businesses are looking. I mean, I spoke with someone from Continental Tire, and he told me that, yes, that was a factor. But I don't necessarily think, and I could be wrong on this, but I don't necessarily think that is the key thing. I think that businesses, first and foremost, look for workforce, look for where their customers are. And North Carolina is very competitive in a lot of those things. Could having a lower corporate tax rate and other tax rates help? Absolutely. But is it necessarily the difference in every business decision? No, it's not.
Well, aside from talking about the economy, Pat McCrory and Walter Dalton have spent a lot of time talking about education, and when they do, a theme seems to emerge. They both stress linking businesses and schools so students graduate with the skills needed to land a job, and they say that they want to make sure that kids are on the right track early on. That will help. But they have different ways of accomplishing those things, and WFAE's Lisa Miller put together this piece to sum all this up.
Walter Dalton stands in the entrance of the First Ward Child Development Center in Charlotte. It serves mainly low-income children to make sure they're ready for kindergarten. This is a big part of Dalton's education strategy, getting kids prepared early on.
That's why the pre-K programs are so, so important. And that's why the cuts to pre-K, I think, were so, so devastating.
Dalton wants to restore the deep cuts to the state's pre-kindergarten program and even add some additional spots. He also wants to gradually raise teacher pay from $47,000 to the national average, which stood at $56,000 last year.
This plan says we're going to respect our teachers. And if you watched what went on in Raleigh during this session, I presided over the Senate, they did take drastic cuts to education, but there was also a rhetoric that at times I felt was very disrespectful to our teachers.
Dalton expects the first year of his plan to cost an additional $626 million. He'd pay for that partly by pushing mail order companies like Amazon to pay state sales tax and removing a $3,500 tax break to most businesses and limiting that to small businesses. Pat McCrory says the state can't afford Dalton's ideas. Instead, he wants to focus money on first through third grades to make sure kids are reading at grade level. It's the emphasis of a commercial in which he brought out one of his high school teachers.
Sometimes a student is just special.
If kids aren't reading at grade level by the end of third grade, they'll be held back. The idea is to make sure they have the basics early on.
When he does that for North Carolina, I'll give him a gold star.
Well, that legislation has already been passed. It's part of changes pushed by national Republican leaders, including the former governor of Florida, Jeb Bush. He's appeared on the campaign trail with McCrory several times.
Hopefully, I had some influence in getting that done, and I'm very proud of the legislature doing that. But now we've got to put in place the necessary resources and the curriculum and the strategy to make it happen.
So where do you get the extra resources then?
We're going to have to share these resources because there isn't any new money.
Both McCrory and Dalton agree schools need to coordinate better with businesses to make sure students are prepared for the jobs companies need. Dalton wants to base college funding in part on the number of students who complete degrees.
We want to have some performance measures for the people that complete the courses, complete the degrees, and fund some based on who goes out the door with the competency that they need.
On this, McCrory and Dalton agree. For McCrory's part, he says higher education needs to do a better job of opening its doors to businesses and have them review curriculum.
To make sure that the universities and our community colleges are graduating kids with the skills needed to get a job, not the skills to necessarily meet an academic professor's idealism who's never held a job in the private sector.
If McCrory wins, he'll likely deal with a Republican legislature. Dalton, on the other hand, says he expects to have to use the office as a bully pulpit to push his agenda.
So, Lisa, if Walter Dalton is the next governor, how effective would his use of a bully pulpit be with a Republican legislature?
Well, I asked him that, you know, when he came to unroll his education plan here in Charlotte. You know, he talked about things like raising teacher pay, bringing back some of those pre-K cuts. And I said, hey, you know, Governor Perdue has tried these things for the last couple of years. What makes you think you can do a better job? Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically he said he thinks he's more persuasive. First of all, he said, well, I'm not Governor Perdue. But
he said that many, many times.
He said he's more persuasive. But basically what it comes down to, he says, is that he knows there are going to be battles he can't win and that he's going to have to use the bully pulpit. And he'll try to, you know, do that with specific amounts of money and things like that. But it's going to be difficult working for him to get some of these things like, you know, teacher pay, right, those big cuts, bringing back with a Republican legislature.
Dalton is pushing funding colleges based on graduation rates. McCrory, I think, is also supportive of this. But how much momentum does this idea have? Do you know?
Well, you know, there are other states who are talking about this and trying this. Indiana is one of those. And in South Carolina, you hear Nikki Haley talking about this a lot. Mm-hmm. She's tried to get a commission together of higher ed folks to figure out how this has worked over the last year and a half. And so far, it's still kind of in its infancy, the discussions. But here in North Carolina, you know, some of the pushes from Republican leaders as far as the fourth grade reading and things like that, that started to come through.
And both Walter Dalton and Pat McCrory have plans for high school students that sound similar on the surface. At least that's what Walter Dalton told me on this program. But actually, they seem to be quite different. Do you know what they have in mind in a nutshell?
Yeah. They are very different, actually. So McCrory actually wants a whole separate vocational degree program. So you'd have a college, one more geared to college curriculum, the other more to vocational. Walter Dalton is looking at these early college high schools, which are basically five-year high schools where you can earn up to an associate's degree getting through there.
I want to talk very quickly about charter schools, vouchers, performance pay for teachers when we come back after the break.
Sure.
And then we'll branch out into other races around the state as we continue on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Pottery Festival, featuring over 100 potters from the Carolinas and other regions on Saturday, November 10th from 10 to 4 at the Cleveland Mall. Information at carolinapotteryfestival.org. And the Map Shop, offering globes, framed maps, flags, travel guides, luggage, and more to help travelers explore the world. Located in Charlotte at the corner of Moorhead and Kings Drive, or online at mapshop.com. Weather.com. One of the issues we've heard little about during this election campaign is climate change, but Hurricane Sandy has certainly thrust that topic into the spotlight. It's a complex, challenging problem, both scientifically and politically, but on Election Day, we step away from the politics and focus on how scientists are communicating with those who make public policy to help them and citizens understand what is happening and the potential consequences. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, an overview of how we'll vote on Election Day, potential disputes, provisional ballots, and the Hurricane Sandy's effects on the election.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's our pre-election wrap-up with Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, Dr. Bitzer from Catawba College, Michael Tomczyk from WFAE News, Lisa Miller and Julie Rose also from WFAE News. Quickly wrapping up the gubernatorial race, where do the two candidates stand on charter schools, vouchers, performance pay for teachers?
So charter schools is something that McCrory really stresses. And, of course, the 100-school cap was lifted recently. So, you know, a bunch of charter schools are opening up over the next year or two. And McCrory says, you know, we need to get them opening up faster, actually. But then it kind of comes into play as far as, well, how do you get that oversight there? Because basically you have the same number of people looking over all the charter schools as there were, you know, when there were only 100 of them. Dalton thinks we should have raised the cap, but he says we should have basically just put another cap on it. So he hasn't given a number for that. So he definitely hasn't stressed that as much. As far as vouchers, McCrory, what he has said is that he is in favor of them. You know, this is basically giving parents money to enroll their kids in private schools. But he's only in favor of them, he says, at this point at least, when it comes to kids with disabilities who parents feel like they're not being served in the public schools, or academically gifted kids who parents feel, you know, kids and parents feel like they're not being served there. Dalton is against vouchers. And performance pay is something that is, you know, coming to North Carolina. McCrory stresses that a lot, how he wants to, you know, pay good teachers more. Dalton, what he stresses is that he doesn't want there to be competition among teachers at the same school, for example. So he wants performance pay to be given to a team of teachers who have showed that they can get their kids performing well in tests.
Thank you. We're going to move on to some congressional and county commission races here. We'll add we're going to add Julie Rose to the mix of Michael Tomczyk and Michael Bitzer. Let's start with the 8th congressional district. Julie, the Democratic incumbent Larry Kissel is there, who has pretty much been abandoned by his party, and he's facing Republican challenger Richard Hudson. Kissel voted against the president on several occasions in this last session of Congress. Is that why the National Party isn't throwing much weight behind his candidacy, or do they simply think there is no chance for this guy to win in a redrawn district that is primarily Republican?
Well, since the day Kissel was elected back in 2008, the National Republican Congressional Committee has been attacking him. So the Republicans have always seen this as something they can pick up. It's consistently a contested race. It's a very contested district and got a real mix, a lot of moderate folks. And, you know, as to why the Democrats have abandoned him, which they would argue they have not abandoned him in this race. You know, I mean, it has a lot to do with where they feel like they can pick things up in other parts of the country. So there are other races where they feel like maybe there's a little bit more at stake for them. But Kissel, I mean, this is a district that, because of the redrawn boundaries, is now showing in most, you know, all those little maps where you've got the red and the blue and then kind of the purplish districts and, right. You know, what can they pick up? Well, the 8th is considered leaning Republican. Hudson has the advantage.
But he voted against the president's health care package.
Kissel did, yes.
Now, he did that. Kissel did that. Was he doing it because he voted his own conscience, or did he do it because he knew his constituents in that district didn't want it? And how will that play?
Kissel says consistently he votes the way the people he represents want him to vote. And also his big thing that he spoke about with regard to the Affordable Care Act was the cuts that it made to Medicare and the seniors, the way it treated the seniors, that he just couldn't support it. And then it gets a little murky because, you know, Richard Hudson, the Republican, is marching around the district telling people, well, you know, Kissel voted for it, you know, 29 times or whatever. He's throwing out these numbers. Their early efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, Larry Kissel did not support, and then he started supporting it. So it has been kind of a back and forth, but.
And Richard Hudson, who's the Republican, has worked in Washington for several other congressional folks. So he says that he knows the people and he understands the system. So he's running as a Washington insider. Can a Republican successfully run as a Washington insider in this political climate?
Well, he doesn't call himself a Washington insider. He says he understands this area because he grew up in Concord. Mm-hmm. He also talks about, you know, in fact, I don't actually ever hear him saying, I understand how Washington works. I mean, he is running as an outsider, but the big challenge for Richard Hudson is that he and Larry Kissel actually agree on a lot of the key policies, mm-hmm. you know, and so what Hudson has to do is walk around and say, Larry Kissel's masquerading, in fact, as a conservative and I'm the real conservative and you should look at Larry Kissel's voting record.
He paints Larry Kissel in his campaign commercials as Obama's guy.
Right.
How do the people in the district feel about Larry Kissel?
You know, the people in the district, there's a big swath of the district that doesn't know Larry Kissel or Richard Hudson.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's the big trick.
The biggest challenge that both candidates have got. I mean, you've got Rowan County, you've got Davidson County, and you've got Randolph County that all believe their congressman is now Howard Coble. And they're going to vote for Howard Coble. And when they show up tomorrow mm-hmm. on the ballot, there are going to be two names that, hey, who are these folks? Where's my congressman? So
yeah. I think that jobs have been a big issue here, obviously, but when the two candidates have talked about jobs, they seem to have a slightly different angle on how they would bring those jobs back to North Carolina. Here's Larry Kissel.
I believe the best thing we can do is bring our jobs back, put an emphasis upon American manufacturing, make it in America. If we spend taxpayer money, it should be spent on American-made goods, American-grown goods.
Agreed.
That's my passion. That's my belief. And that's why I went to Washington.
So Kissel focuses on bringing back American manufacturing, while his opponent, Richard Hudson, talks about taxes.
I talk to employers every day across this district, and they tell me they want to expand, they want to hire people, but they don't know what the taxes are going to be next year. And they don't know what the regulatory scheme is going to look like because regulations are just piling out of Washington. And so we can get this economy going again, but we got to get Washington out of the way first.
So Richard Hudson there, Mike, is talking also. I mean, one of his key things that he hits on is we need to, I mean, it's what you're hearing from conservative Republicans, smaller government, rein in wasteful spending, repeal Affordable Care, that the Affordable Care Act, that's the regulatory scheme. People don't know what it's going to look like and how it's going to be and how it's going to affect small business. But what's really interesting is, you know, I spent time with Kissel knocking on doors in the Davidson County area and then with Richard Hudson out there campaigning in up in this new area of District 8. And they're both kind of talking about – Kissel never mentions Democrat. He never says, I'm a Democrat, when he's knocking on doors. He says, look, I'm the guy who's been representing you. America, buy America, made in America. Mm-hmm. This is a manufacturing area. I worked in textiles for 27 years. I get you. I get these concerns. And Hudson goes into the area and is working a little bit more of the traditional conservative Republican message, smaller government, reigning taxes, affordable care, you know. And the struggle has been for him to make sure people understand Obama and Kissel are the same person, even though the voting record is much more nuanced
right.
than that.
Is this an uphill battle for – Who for whom is this an uphill battle?
Kissel, I think. It's always been an uphill battle for Kissel in that district since 2008.
Consider this. In 2008, that old district voted for Barack Obama with 52% of the vote. In this new drawn district, John McCain would have won with 57% of the vote. So it is a dramatic swing in terms of the voting behavior of this district.
Michael Bitzer in the 9th congressional district. Republican Robert Pittenger is running against former Democratic Mecklenburg County Commission Chairwoman Jennifer Roberts. This is a Republican district. How long has it been so, and what was the impact of redistricting?
Since 1963, Republican has represented this particular district. And I think, you know, it switched. It moved more north. It went out of Gaston County into Iredell County and extends into Union County. Jennifer Roberts certainly has the name recognition as the kind of probably successful Democrat who can run a very good campaign. The problem is this district, again, like in the 8th, is so heavily drawn to favor the Republicans that I don't see anybody, Charlie Cook, Stuart Rothenberg, nobody's really got this on a radar list in terms of this would be an upset in terms of, right. of a big win if the Democrats were able to pick off this.
Because it's Sue Myrick's seat, and she's been there for a long time, and she, too, is a Republican. But Michael Tomczyk, Pittenger has a lot of money, and he's been plowing a lot of his own money into this campaign. If it's a Republican district held by a Republican and most likely to be held by a Republican this time around, why does he need to do that? Because Roberts can't match that money.
So you're just going to leave the money on the table? I mean, it's a campaign. Nothing's for sure. It's like we were talking about at the very top and what Mr. Bitzer was saying. You know, there's always this possibility of a seismic event. But I mean, you look at how he's been spending that money, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I've talked to him briefly, you've seen in some of his ads, he always will try to describe Jennifer Roberts as a traditional liberal who believes in bigger government, as does Mr. Obama. So again, it's always, you know, all the Republican races, there's always mm-hmm. this link to, oh, this person's actually just like the president. And obviously the records, as Julie said, are usually more nuanced than that. But, you know, what's interesting though is Roberts' responses to that. I mean, she says when she's out in the district, she says, "I'm an American." People identify too much with their parties. They should do more than just the party. So clearly she sees as well the writing on the wall that this is a district that, you know, you can't win waving the Democratic flag around.
So aside from him talking about her being a liberal and her talking about herself being an American, what are they talking about on the trail?
Well, I mean, they both end up lining up pretty neatly with most of the major policies of each party. I mean, Pittenger said that he wants to repeal Obamacare. And then you have Roberts, who has said that she wants to defend Obamacare. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they kind of line up neatly on some other ones as well.
Here's one of the things that Robert Pittenger says about the health care plan.
A health plan that we all want is one where we have a relationship, every patient does, with their physician. And today, those relationships are really focused now on the government, and the government makes those decisions. And that's really not what America's all about. That's not the strength of our healthcare system. We've had the best in the world.
Is it true that the Obama plan allows the government to make your decisions, your medical decisions? Is that true?
No, that's definitely not true.
It's
certainly more nuanced than that.
So meanwhile, Jennifer Roberts also talks about healthcare, but she wants to look at healthcare costs.
And I tell you, one area that we haven't done enough on is cost control. You look at the pharmaceuticals, if you look at some of the high costs, the fact that healthcare costs continue to rise higher than the CPI, you know, these are things that we can work on. We can look at better outcomes. We need to do that in coordinated fashion between the government and the private sector.
And I think that's an example of where you hear Roberts kind of trying to strike this line between being, you know, a little bit more moderate. It's not, hey, the Affordable Care Act is the greatest thing ever. It's there are some good things there. We shouldn't throw it out, but we need to start working on cost control. So that's an example for her trying to get a little bit more towards the middle as far as, you know, knowing what would need to happen to win this district.
In fact, cost control was one of the reasons the president pushed the health care plan, and we've kind of lost sight of that in the recent years as people fight against the implementation of the plan, which has yet to roll out completely, just beginning to roll out. So is this, if the president is reelected, is this something that he will have to re-explain to the public going forward?
It's a potential, certainly. And I think, you know, there's going to be continued pushes, particularly in a Republican-dominated U.S. House. They are going to continue to put this vote back up. They're going to force Democrats to go back on the line. There's got to be some kind of compromise, but the willingness of the president and the House Republicans to get in on this is really critical.
And, you know, Mike, I can just throw this in regarding the 8th, you know, I mean, because you hear the exact same kind of conversation going on in the 8th District as in the 9th with regard to affordable affordable care. And there are a lot of different ways to approach this, but you're hearing Larry Kissel, for example, is talking as a Democrat about, well, you know, I don't think everything in the Affordable Care Act is bad. I mean, let's not just throw the whole thing out, the baby out with the bathwater. We could, you know, let's implement pieces of this that we fought for as individual legislation. So there are a lot. I don't think the question is who, no matter who's elected, and Romney's going to have, he's already said, look, I think some of the stuff in there is pretty good too. So, you know, whoever's elected, we're not going to see the whole thing trashed. I think, you know, there will be pieces of it that are going to have to be debated and relitigated.
That lines up with popular opinion as well. They like a lot of the key things, particularly, you know, keeping students on till they're 26 on parents. You know, a lot of the individual pieces score very highly in terms of public opinion. The weird thing is when you lump it all together and it gets classified as Obamacare, it turns highly negative. So, I mean, a lot of this is going to have to be done in terms of selling.
Finishing up in the 9th District, Michael, you described Sue Myrick as a moderate Republican with a penchant for working across the aisle.
One of the few, from time to time.
So given that, who best fills her seat of these two candidates? Pittenger, who's more to the right than Sue Myrick, or Jennifer Roberts, who is certainly not a Republican.
Certainly not a Republican. But I think, you know, what we're going to probably see is the continued polarization in the House. Pittenger fits much more into the model of the Eric Cantor wing of the U.S. House of Representatives Republicans, the Republican Conference. So, you know, if there's an opportunity to work across the lines, across the aisle, I think Jennifer Roberts would be better at that. But the likelihood is we're going to continue to see the parties polarized.
Lisa Miller, we're going to move to the county commission races. And for the first time in a long time, the three at-large seats are all open. Historically, which party tends to win these races?
Well, often in presidential years, it's the Democrats. Party. So, I mean, this is kind of, although all these other races are overshadowing the county commission, this is kind of a momentous occasion for the county commission because you have those three at-large candidates all not running again. Two of them ran for the 9th congressional district, so they're out of the running. And basically, when you're looking at this, I mean, you're looking at the balance of the party on the county commission. So it for, you know, most of the last two, you know, this term, it was five Democrats to four Republicans. And then Harold Cogdell, who is a at-large commissioner who decided not to run, you know, he became an independent. So it was four to one. So, I mean, this will be interesting to see what happens because you got a lot of issues coming up here. You still have people smoldering from the revaluations and, you know, all the latest DSS investigations and things like that. You know, that's coming up on the horizon about how to deal with that.
There are three Democrats, three Republicans, and a Libertarian running for these three open seats. Wayne Powers is one of the three Republicans running. He's been endorsed by The Observer, interestingly enough, and has been vocal about government in the past as a fill-in talk show host on another radio station. He promises to turn the lights on.
Most of the stuff that goes on has been cloaked in the dark and closed behind closed doors and behind closed curtains, and you can't get in there, I can't get in there, but as a county commissioner, you can rest assured that I'm going to be poking and prodding and turning on lights everywhere I can.
And Mr. Powers has been to everywhere throughout the county, basically campaigning over the last several months. You've heard a lot from him. And one of the other things, you know, that the county does is, you know, it pays a lot of education bills. 30% of their budget is education. So you have a lot of the Republicans talking about sort of reprioritizing or restructuring and, you know, the Democrats saying, OK, yeah, we have to, you know, think how to fund and everything. You don't hear them saying, hey, we can't hold taxes necessarily or hold education cuts off. But for example, Kim Ratliff is talking about different ways of maybe funding education that involves businesses.
But say you give them a tax break, maybe or may not, for their part in helping a school, whether it's to build a new school or to help keep funding a school that is already in that area.
So, you know, basically that's what's coming up on the County Commission.
No. We have one more race to talk about, and we'll do that on the other side of this break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Paycor, providing cloud-based payroll, HR, and timekeeping solutions for over 20 years, serving over 22,000 companies across America with online solutions and personal service. Details at paycor.com. And the 2012 Charlotte Auto Show, featuring over 400 2013 models at the Charlotte Convention Center, November 15th through the 18th. Tickets at charlotteautoshow.com. Coming up at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, Diane and her guests provide an overview of the ways we are casting votes this year. They talk about potential disputes, provisional ballots, and Hurricane Sandy's effect on the election. In other words, this show continues next hour. We will continue, as a matter of fact, in just moments. Stay with us.
Hello, it's Garrison Keillor reminding you that A Prairie Home Companion is heard at 6 o'clock on Saturday, 12 noon on Sunday, right here on 90.7 WFAE. Hope you'll join us for music and comedy and, of course, the news from Lake Wobegon. Saturdays at 6, Sundays at noon on listener-supported WFAE Charlotte's NPR News station.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Before we wrap up the County Commission races, one of the races that's interesting to me, at least, is the Bill James race, because it's the first time in a long time that Republican Bill James has a challenger in District 6, Connie Green Johnson, a Democrat. And yet I haven't heard much about this race. Why?
Well, so it's been 10 years since the last time Bill James had a challenger. And probably part of the reason you haven't heard too much about, you know, this in the general election is that district so often, you know, so heavily Republican. But you heard a lot about this probably in the primary. He also had a primary opponent, Ed Driggs, who ran against him. And he very much, you know, he said, hey, I believe a lot of the conservative policies that Bill James does, but I will not be as offensive, basically, in the way I present myself, because Bill James obviously has upset a lot of people in the past with the things he says.
He's notorious for saying things that upset a lot of people, but obviously not the people in his district.
Well, you know, in last election time, I did a story, you know, about folks in the district, you know, why Bill James always gets elected, because he's upsets a lot of people. And I talked to people, you know, going to vote, and they said, yeah, you know what? I believe in a lot of the same things Bill James says. Do I believe, you know, when he opens his mouth up and, you know, says offensive things? No, I think I don't agree with those things, and I get embarrassed sometimes. But they said, you know, hey, he goes through the budget with a fine tooth. He is a champion for, you know, making sure spending, you know, things are, mm-hmm. you know, he's very fiscally attuned.
Has Bill James been out on the stump? Because he's somewhat of a recluse, except for the county commission meetings. He doesn't go out a lot,
but he is very vocal as far as emails, online, blogs, and all that. So he is quite vocal in those regards.
We're going to talk about some things that are arcane for a moment or two here, and that is the judges' races, and particularly with regard to the Supreme Court judge races in judicial races in North Carolina. You know, the president, one of the legacies that the president of the United States leaves behind is if he gets an opportunity to appoint a Supreme Court justice, that person generally outlives his presidency and puts a stamp on the presidency. We voters choose – this is our chance to have our own legacy. Mm-hmm. We choose the Supreme Court justices running in nonpartisan races, and most of us know nothing about these people. But this year, a conservative super PAC has spent $1.3 million advertising in favor of incumbent Paul Newby, who I believe also got the endorsement of The Observer. Is that because of the name recognition factor with his challenger, Sam Ervin IV, the grandson of the late U.S. Senator? Is that why this money's going in for Newbie?
It certainly is. And when you have these kinds of races that are so low information, I mean, generally voters will look to a candidate's party affiliation and, oh, I know what a Democrat stands for. I know what a Republican stands for. It's kind of cues. When you have nonpartisan races, though these two men are registered a Democrat and registered Republican, It is still very hard for the average voter to get that kind of signal to make the difference once they get to that
down ballot.
So why
do we do it that way? If we know nothing about these people, because most people don't do their homework on these races and they're not labeled, how are we to make an intelligent decision?
We are hopeful that the voters will take the time to investigate and learn about it, or, as Newbie is doing, see it on TV. I mean, the banjo ad is, you know, the jingle is quite effective, and that's where all this money is coming into it.
Julie?
And, you know, Mike, I've done some reporting on, you know, the weaknesses, the advantages of this kind of a setup. I mean, I think there may be like 15 states. It's a pretty good mix across the country, those that elect, those that have them appointed, those that elect them in partisan races. And there is a movement afoot to change the way our judges are chosen in North Carolina, because one of the additional disadvantages to a voter of having to choose judges is that you also can't – judges are very limited in what they can say on the stump. So they can only really say – look, I show up. I'm very fair. I'm reliable. You know, I listen to both sides. Yeah. They can't say in the cases of, I mean, just like, you know, with the Supreme Court, when we see those big hearings, they can't say, you know, this is how I would rule on these domestic violence issues. And this is how I would rule. And oftentimes, and you can't really, it's very difficult to go and say, here's what their voting record has been, especially when you get down the ticket to like district court judges. Mm-hmm. There has been in the last couple of years, an effort by the North Carolina Bar Association to start evaluating judges by the people who spend most time in front of them. So lawyers have been across the state have been surveyed, and then they're in and that about.
Yeah, but aren't
you know,
they going to say good things about the judges they appear for in cases that they win, and bad things if they repeatedly lose cases in certain?
Sure. But they're asked questions like, you know, are they impartial? You know, are they professional? It's those kinds of things, and then they average those. I mean, you got a 1,000 people who get surveyed, so you can go to the North Carolina Bar Association's website and you can see the judicial performance evaluation. And they also evaluated people who are running in those races. But the other thing I think that Professor Bitzer is, you know, talking about with regard, this is sort of a newer phenomenon for us to have our Supreme Court races be influenced by outside money, obviously, because of Citizens United. But also, this is a swing vote. I mean, this is an important position where the Republicans, if they lose this spot, lose the majority on the Supreme Court.
Because they would then have the three branches of government if McCrory goes in as governor and Newbie is reelected to his position. Is the Supreme Court outcome in North Carolina at the state level as important as it is at the national level to people who are political?
It can be because of cases like the redistricting cases that's coming up through the process. So, yes, I mean, Supreme Court does have some impact on average citizens.
So we have 10 minutes left. And I think we'll spend them on the presidency.
Well, that's going on?
You know, there's a presidential contest. Did you know? In America, in American presidential election politics, there's something called the October surprise. And this year that was Hurricane Sandy. It impacted a very blue part of the country. Mm-hmm. And they reported on this morning on Morning Edition. Is there a way to estimate the impact of a hurricane like this that really devastated major portions of the Northeast, in which millions of people are putting together their lives, don't have a place to live, have no heat? Are they thinking about the election? Can they think about the election? Can they vote? Where will they vote? There's no power in some places. How are you going to plug the machines in?
This is new territory for a lot of us. And I think, you know, one thing that needs to be said is New York and New Jersey is going to be reliably blue, even though we may see a couple hundred thousand voters probably not show up normally that we would see. The big question in my mind is Democrats have as a base urban areas, and New York City is a crucial area that they basically just run the numbers up, and that can have an impact on the popular vote. And if that turnout is depressed potentially in New York City, in major urban areas in New Jersey, that could drop President Obama's popular vote totals down to where, granted, we're talking about a very small likelihood, but one winner who gets the popular vote, the other gets the electoral vote. Welcome back to 2000.
Well, the race is already so close. When you take away a couple million people from and remove their ability to vote,
yeah,
wouldn't it have an outcome?
I can't help but think that it would.
Of course, Obama did have a chance to look more presidential during all of this,
yes,
because it's the job of the president in times like
Commander-in-chief.
This.
And the newest polls seem to show that was a bit of an advantage for him. I mean, the polls that are just out yesterday from both Public Policy Polling and Pew Research show President Obama up 50 to 47, I think, are the numbers that they're showing. And that they seem to think, you know, looking like you're a man in charge who knows how to get things done and protect the people. And Mitt Romney struggled. Yeah.
Two-thirds of the respondents said that he did a good job in terms of showing presidential leadership. That helps in the final week of the campaign.
And it also puts Mitt Romney, it puts any challenger in an awkward position, because what can you say? What can you do? You're not in charge. He backed off from his campaign. He turned one of his campaign events into a fundraiser for the
relief effort.
So, I mean, what did he – obviously, he wasn't in a position to do anything. So did he do a good job of what he did?
I think his campaign managers recognized that the race got frozen at that point, and he had some momentum going into this final week. With the race being frozen and then the president coming out very positive, it looks like the swing has moved back into the Obama camp nationally.
But has it moved back in time to gain any traction? Because he really lost a lot of support, at least he appeared to have lost a lot of support, the president did, after that first debate.
Well, look, I'm not hearing anybody say, oh, yeah, absolutely, the president's got this wrapped up. I mean, this is too close to call, and it will be close. You know, it was going to be close. It's going to be close now. You know, I'm sure in the morning after quarterbacking that will take place, people will say there will be Republican strategists who will say Sandy really hurt us. And there will be, Democrats saying, no, we had it anyway. I mean, all of that's going to be part of the equation. But at this point, it's going to be a long night, I think, is all we really know.
You mentioned the PPP. One of you mentioned the PPP poll. PPP stands for what?
Public Policy Polling.
Okay. And they keep coming out. The last one I saw was released late Saturday. It had President Obama leading Mitt Romney 50 to 47% nationally. That may have changed if there's been another one.
That's the one. And it's the same as the Pew Research numbers that came out the final one, basically.
This is the first lead of 3 points either candidate has had in weeks. President Obama led in all 3 days of the poll. His approval rating is now in the positive range. The Washington Post ABC News poll has the candidates dead even, at least they did yesterday. While Nate Silver's 538 blog, this is the blog that he started 4 years ago that counts the electoral college, potential electoral college votes, which has now been folded into the New York Times. But he has the president at 307 to Romney's 230. That's up from yesterday in the electoral vote. You need 270 to win. Mm-hmm. He places Obama's chances of winning at 86.3%. How does he arrive at these numbers, and what's your take on them?
He arrives at these numbers by basically using a mathematical formula that takes a lot of polls and basically averages them along with some economic data. So there are some things that happen throughout a day-to-day activity that could move the model one way or the other. But basically, he's taking an average. And that's what most pundits who are looking at this say. Don't take one poll. Take an average of them. And we are very tight, but it all comes down to who gets to 270. That's the number to watch tomorrow night.
And the thing we've been hearing all through this campaign is, paths to that 270. Mm-hmm. Like, who has more ways to get those 270 electoral college votes? And President Obama, by far, has more ways to get there. There's more flexibility for him in terms of states he could lose. And
even if 8 million people in New York and New Jersey stay away because they can't vote?
Yeah.
Well, because, like, as Professor Bitzer was saying, I mean, those are states that are going to go to, they're going to go blue anyway. So even if a lot fewer people show up, they're so solidly Democratic that those Electoral College votes are already President Obama's, you know, to be had. So
the advantage that Obama had coming out of the 08 election was basically he was able to crack the solid Republican South along with a very solid Republican desert Southwest. I mean, he peeled off North Carolina, Virginia, and Florida, along with New Mexico, Nevada, and Colorado. If he pulls those six states off again, and that's a far stretch, but if he can do those six states again, there is no conceivable way that I see that Romney can get to 270.
And what we've consistently been hearing, I mean, for us here locally, this whole being a battleground state is a new thing for us since 2008. All of these presidents, I mean, I think I know many people who would be happy to go back to not being a battleground state anymore so we could get our television advertising back.
It could return to car commercials.
Exactly. I mean, you know, I'm happy to see anything advertised except an attack ad in the presidential campaign. But, you know, there has consistently been the talk that, look, President Obama can win this election and lose North Carolina. Oh, he doesn't have to have North Carolina. Mitt Romney needs North Carolina. And I think it'll be interesting to see how the North Carolina folks respond to that. Right here in Charlotte, we've got Mayor McCrory. I mean, excuse me, Mayor Fox, who has been a very, very vocal, visible surrogate for President Obama. You know, the DNC came here. It was like, we're going to keep this state blue for President Obama. If it's not, you know, there's a little bit of a that's an ego hit folks here.
Isn't the first lady here today with Mariah Carey to campaign, or is that yesterday?
Yes.
She's here today.
Today. Earlier in this conversation, very quickly, we talked about when these campaigns know who's going to win and who's going to lose. When you have a Governor Christie of New Jersey, who's a Republican governor in a Democratic state, coming out and saying the President Obama's doing a terrific job. Brownie, you're doing a terrific job with helping us recover from this tragedy. And you have Governor Nikki Haley in South Carolina canceling campaign appearances for Mitt Romney this past weekend so she can focus on the hacking scandal in the Department of Revenue there. Is the handwriting on the wall? Are these people maneuvering for the next election?
We will start the 2016 presidential campaign cycle the day or the minute after we declare the winner tomorrow. So, yes, they're all positioning themselves.
Do you think we will declare a winner tomorrow night or even Wednesday morning? Or will it go to the end of the week? Or will it go into next month? Or will it go to the Congress?
If it does, I'm finding the nearest bunker and locking myself in. I predict Wednesday noon, Wednesday afternoon at the latest, we'll know. Probably Wednesday morning, we'll have a good
sense. Why will
it
take so long?
You got to count votes. I mean, Ohio, if we see the kind of turnout that they're predicting, it's going to take a while. Remember back in 2008, it wasn't until Thursday or Friday we knew that this state had flipped from red to blue. So we got to patience.
And Florida is causing a problem right now with early
voting.
There
are some problems in Florida as well. So, you know, there are a variety of things. If Ohio gets into a 0.5% margin of victory one way or the other, they have to do an automatic recount.
Dr. Michael Bitzer from WFAE's The Party Line political blog, also the chair of the Department of Politics and History at Catawba College in Salisbury. Michael Tomczyk, Lisa Miller, Julie Rose from WFAE News. It was fun. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Thank you.